Welcome to Red Ice Creations Radio. My name is Henrik, and we are coming to you from a pretty cold west coast of Sweden. Our website is redicecreations.com. That's the place to go for more radio, our news, our members area, and of course our new webcasts, our live webcasts that you shouldn't miss. We've done programs so far with Chris Knowles, Daniel Tatman, Michael Tesserion, Christopher Morse. That's about 2 hours or even more in some cases of basically TV programs for you to enjoy on a variety of subjects. And we are continuing on that trend. And this coming Saturday, the 15th, we're going to have Jake Kutze with us. Don't miss us. This is a completely new level on live webcasts, as it were. So stay tuned and check out redicecreations.com. On the front page, we have all the information on times and dates and whatnot. And today we have Lawrence Gardner with us. He is a fellow of the Society of Antiquaries of Scotland, distinguished as the Chevalier de Saint-Germain. He's a constitutional historian, a Knights Templar of St. Anthony, and is presidential attaché to the European Council of Princes. Is also, of course, the author of Bloodline of the Holy Grail, The Grail Enigma, Genesis of the Grail Kings, and Lost Secrets of the Sacred Ark, just to mention a few of his titles. And his website is graal.co.uk. That's graal.co.uk. Head over there. There's a lot of information for you there about his books and much more. And I'm really excited about having Lawrence with us here today to talk more about his work. So welcome to the program, Lawrence, and thank you very much for coming on.
Well, hello, Henrik. It's good to be here at last. We've tried a couple of times and not quite made it, but here we are.
Here we are, finally. Exactly. So if you will, give us a little bit of an overview of some of the work and research that you've kind of done over the years here for people who might not be familiar with your work.
Well, the series of books that I have in publication now, there's seven actually in print in various languages and editions. I've got another three on the stocks waiting to come out in the next year or two. The first of the publications was back in 1996, 1995 in Britain, and then it sort of spread into America and other countries, and that was Bloodline of the Holy Grail. The story of the dynastic bloodline of King David and Jesus, and what I did was I progressed, I suppose, the work that was done by Bajant Lee and Lincoln in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, where they set up the scenario for there perhaps being a family descent from Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And that struck me as really exciting stuff, because I'd been involved in noble and sovereign genealogies for some years, and I was sitting on a big box of archive of this particular family line, not knowing quite what to do with it. I thought, wow, you know, they've set up the scene. I can write the book on this. So essentially, that's what I did. The way that it came about was that my main occupation for some while, in fact, I was in the world of finance in the City of London, but I was also running a picture restoration studio. And by the 1970s, that was my main occupation. And within the course of restoring old masters and paintings, which was what I was doing for the London galleries and other galleries in the country, A lot of the work that I was doing was on portraiture and family pictures going back through the ages. And there they were, sort of adorning the staircases of stately homes and whatever. And although they were there, some of the owners of these houses knew very little about the characters that were portrayed. And I got very involved in just trying to piece the stories together as a matter of personal interest, really, trying to create genealogies to see which family was related to who and that sort of thing. And gradually this sort of whole picture came together, and I began to trace it backwards and backwards and backwards, and found that if you can imagine an upturned triangle with a very wide base now at the top, and it was going back to this sort of point and gradually merging together, and I discovered that very many of these families that came out from a family line which was originally referred to, once you get back into the very old stuff, as the family of the Despicini.
Hmm.
Yeah, and this is in the sort of genealogical archives. And
mm-hmm.
That intrigued me, so I found that most of the writings about this were by historians from the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 4th centuries. And lo and behold, I got led to the apostolic constitutions written from the 1st to the 4th centuries of the Catholic Church, and found within that, and within the writings of Eusebius, who was the church chronicler, chronicler for Emperor Constantine in the 4th century, quite a lot about this family of the Despensini, and the description that it gave was that they were the descendants of the family of Jesus.
Hmm.
Now, that intrigued me, because I thought, well, does that really mean that they descended from him, or does it mean they descended from his family? And the Bible gives us quite clearly the fact that he had four brothers and sisters, or apparently, according to other works which I discovered from that era, there were three sisters, so he was sort of one of eight. And so I tried sort of trying to find out from the Vatican archive and from the Catholic Church authorities what that meant, that the family of Jesus, did it mean him or did it mean from his brothers and sisters? And they denied the fact that he had any brothers or sisters, and
yeah.
said that, you know, according to their doctrine, the fact that the Bible says that he had brothers and sisters was wrong.
Hmm.
I said, well, actually, okay, within your own apostolic constitutions, you talk about this family of the Despensini as descended from the family of Jesus. So if you're saying he didn't have brothers or sisters, I take it that you must mean that they descended from him. And they said, well, maybe that was wrong. And so the whole thing got into a terrible mess. And ultimately, what I figured was that it was a bit of each. You know, it had to be. These lines couldn't all come from one person, so they must have come from various members of the family. So I really just tried to track down, and I discovered that from the brothers, quite a lot could be traced, actually, in historical record. And this left a couple of particular lines, which came from Jesus himself. And once I got into the writings of St. Clement and St. Origen and one or two others, and they started, you know, this, we're now sort of in the second century, and they're referring to Mary Magdalene as the bride of Christ in the writings. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. It's exactly what I want. So the book was born, and from then, everything took off. You know, quite suddenly, I didn't have time to restore pictures anymore. I'm
right.
also traveling the world, giving lectures, doing radio interviews, with everybody asking me what the next book was going to be about.
Right, right.
I had no plan to write a next book. And so I just made sure that I did lots of telephone phone-ins, you know, on the radio, and at the lectures had good questions and answer sessions. So what I got was a build-up of the most asked questions. And from those, I wrote the next book, trying to give the answers if I could. And that's what's happened with every book so far. I always answer the most asked questions from the book before.
Right, right. I see. Okay. So, I mean, in regards to your research and in the beginning, what kind of, like, or did you go to any special archives somewhere, or did you have to have, you know, special permits or access, or is this done by going to a few of the libraries around London or Rome, or how did that work?
Well, both, all of those things. Going back to those times, of course, it was pre the internet.
Yeah.
So it was a lot more difficult. It was always also more difficult for me because I wasn't as practiced at it as I am now, and I didn't know as many people to contact as I know now. In fact, I knew very few, so it was a hard slog. And yes, it did mean traipsing into university libraries, you know, going to libraries abroad, trying to find people who could do translations for me, all of this sort of work. So it was very tough going. But to begin, and until I actually got to the second book, there was no pressure on me. You know, I wasn't doing the research for a book. I was just doing it while I was in various places. I thought, well, okay, you know, I can pop into this library, I can pop into that one, I can go to this university while I'm here. Nobody was pushing me. It wasn't until the second book that the pushing began, and suddenly what had taken me, you know, maybe 10 or 12 years to put together for the first book, the publishers now wanted in a year and a half. So it was tougher, and still in very early days of the internet, what I've discovered about the internet, and I do use it a lot, but the problem with it is that although it's, you know, it contains a wealth of information, it's probably also the world's greatest source of misinformation.
Sure.
And so one has to be very, very careful. But the way that I use it is that it's actually quite good for discovering where certain things are held. So instead of it being a very difficult job to discover where a particular manuscript or whatever is now, one can find out quite easily from the internet. From that moment, I leave the internet alone, and I'm straight on to that archive and only dealing with them and the documents at hand.
Yes.
So
yeah.
it's all original research. But what I've discovered is that when one starts to read books, I mean, books like mine and other books written at the same discovers that in looking at the notes and references and the bibliography, that essentially every one of a book, it might be about Bonnie Prince Charlie, it doesn't matter what the subject is, but they're basically all using the books written before them on the same subject as their source material. And the next time somebody writes a book, their book becomes a piece of source material. So I decided that the best thing was to endeavor every time to get back to the original source and to try and find the documents that it all began with. And it was very surprising how often the first person maybe to write and use a particular document, let's say it was from the 10th century or the 12th century, as a piece of information, who'd written the book 100 years ago and had everybody else copy from that book subsequently, what had happened was that the first person had got it wrong.
There you go, yeah.
And it's incredible on how many subjects you find that there's this incorrect interpretation or maybe a miscopying of something.
Mm-hmm.
It's just gone on and on and on. And I thought, wow, this is no good at all. You know, if I have to try and maintain a credibility in what I do, there are two things that must apply from the beginning. And the first one is that I mustn't set out with a preconception of what I'm going to end up with.
Right.
I mustn't decide what I want to find and then try and prove it fair means or foul. What I wanted to do was to try to get back to the oldest documents available on the subject and simply to record what they say. And so, you know, people have said to me quite often, or they've said to each other, maybe in discussion, you know, Lawrence Gardner thinks. Well, I have to confess that nowhere in any of this have I ever particularly thought anything. You know, what I do is to relay what other people have written and said through the ages.
Right, right.
And there are differences, you know. I mean, one can read a newspaper report today, let's say, about a football match, and both journalists will give you the same result. You know, this was the score, Team A beat Team B. But it might well be that each of the journalists supports the opposite teams.
Right.
So the reasons that they'll give you for why Team A beat Team B will be completely different and tell you a different story, but with the same result. And that's what happens in history. And, you know, if one looks at a history of something, let's say it's the Battle of Agincourt in the 1400s of Britain against the French armies at Agincourt, you know, the result of the battle nobody can dispute. But when one reads the English history of it, and then when one reads the French history of the battle, it's an entirely different story to the different battle. And so I had to be very, very careful of that sort of thing. And every time I found a document on the subject I was looking for, I tried to find others of the same period, you know, other people who were there at the time. And again, it was quite surprising how different some of them were. And what I learned from that, the biggest lesson that I've learned, is that history, really, that we get taught in our schools, you in Sweden and me here in England, is that actually the histories are simply the result of what somebody wrote and thought.
Yes.
We don't get taught alternatives, do we? We just get taught a story, a history, and it might be right or it might not. And so it's been an intriguing journey.
It's a very tricky business. And again, I mean, cross-referencing documents that are several hundred years old, that can't be the easiest job in the world, right?
It can't be.
No.
And it isn't, you know. And to be honest, you know, I didn't actually, I was researching for quite a long period of time. But, you know, when my first book was published, I was in my 50s. And, you know, it's not often that one does a complete career turn. And it wasn't just that it was a career turn. It ended up being the hardest thing I'd ever done in my life.
Hmm.
And it still is. And yet the compulsion is there to carry on, because in as much as that other people come up with all their questions, I have my own.
Yeah.
I write a book and I think, wow, I wonder why that happened. Or so it seems to be a never-ending thing. You know, I'm probably going to be still making notes at my funeral.
Well, I mean, again, I've said it before, but when talking to especially people who are looking into history and so forth, I mean, we can't expect to summarize the history of the world in a few books. I mean, we're talking about huge amount of material here, and then on top of that, everyone should agree, and that's, you know, even more difficult, you know.
Oh yeah, it is strange. And what I've discovered is that you know, so many subject areas are kind of linked together. You know, you'll notice it in my books that I mean, essentially they begin with the story of the bloodline and with the Holy Grail mythology and that sort of thing, but they move off into areas of medicine and into science scientific subjects and all sorts of things. And it's quite surprising how these subject areas are linked together, and yet our academic institutions separate them totally and build walls around them.
Yeah.
And it has been surprising for me, you know, how one can achieve very high qualifications in a subject, but know very little, if not nothing, about the other things that tangent from it.
Yeah.
And somebody within those can get their qualifications and know very little about the other subject. So what I tried to do was to begin to knock down the walls and the barriers. And there it was, religion, science, general history, medicine, mythology, all of these things linked together across these boundaries. And it gets very, very complicated. So, you know, in a way, gathering the information and doing the research is one hard part of the task. But the rest of it is how to make it readable in a book.
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with all these separate areas. And, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm not a doctor. You know, I'm not qualified in these areas. I'm simply like a journalist reporting on what was written and what was said and what still is being written and said. And I suppose that the biggest problem that people have these days, and I was as guilty of this as anybody, is that just about whatever one looks at from the past is that you try and judge it with the mind of today.
Yeah.
And it's an impossibility. You can't actually do that in the end because it doesn't work. And you've got to accept the fact that people in different time frames, within different cultures, had different viewpoints. And something that we might regard today as ridiculous, they didn't at that time. Something we might regard now as particularly violent and nasty, they didn't in those days. And you've got to try and get into the mindset of these people and to work out, you know, why they were involved in certain things at certain times. And it's kind of weird. You know, I kind of wish in a way that the publishing market itself worked very differently, because whenever I write a book, I find that lots of my readers start sending me information and links to other things. And that means that within about a year of writing the book, I could very easily update it, not make too many corrections, but actually expand some of the things I'd begun to write about and make more of them and make them more understandable. But one isn't allowed to do that because the first book is still selling, and, you know, they don't like second editions very much anymore. What they want is a wholly new book about something else.
Really?
Just stuck, yeah.
Oh, there you go. Mm. So, I mean, if we were to, let's say, talk a little bit about the bloodline of Jesus then, I mean, in a nutshell, is there any kind of conclusion you've come to in regards to this topic? Do you know for certain now that, yes, it really was a bloodline that is still, you know, alive today, or is that all bunk? What's your opinion today about that?
Well, my opinion about it is that if one takes the majority of writers of the early era, let's say the first, second, third, and fourth centuries, and again, it was a very big thing in the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th century, it came to the fore again in a very large way. If one assumes that the majority of writers who are with a common opinion have kind of got it right, then yes, on the basis of that, as historical information, I'm thoroughly convinced of it. I mean, there's too much around that just agrees with each other, and it might come from Greece, or it might come from Sardinia, or it might come from North Africa, it might come from Rome, or whatever, but people totally divorced from each other were writing up the same story. So yes, I'm thoroughly convinced. I mean, I don't feel that it's proven, but I don't feel that anything we learn in history is proven. One can simply work on the basis that those people who were there at the time, just like journalists today, recorded this family and its doings as historical fact.
Right.
So one can only go along with that. What follows from that is that for a number of years and for a number of centuries, it was, just like a descent in any noble family, very important in terms of one's position in society and that sort of thing. So it got written about quite a lot. It was this word Despicini that flummoxed me to start with. Once I jumped that hurdle and realized what it meant, I mean, the word actually means heirs of the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
That's the word Despicini, it's a Greek word.
Oh.
So, you know, that's where it comes from. But once one's hooked into that and looks for it and finds it in various places, you're into the family line. And yeah, so in Bloodline of the Holy Holy Grail. I recorded everything that I could find about this family and went through many generations. I mean, right from the first century, I can't remember now, but I think I took it, I mean, almost to modern times, but not quite. But to do that, I had to decide which line to follow each time, because it's quite extraordinary if you take anybody in the first century, and let's say they had two children, and each of those married, and each of those marriages had two children, and so it went on. What actually happens, and I think I wrote about this in Realm of the Ring Lords, which was my third book, I worked out the mathematics on that, and forgetting the fact that some families don't have any children, and also that others have more than two, you know, some have six or eight or whatever, but yeah. Forgetting all of that, and just working on the two-by-two principle, the number of potential births in the year 2000 from a starting point of the first century came to a 26-digit figure.
Really?
Yeah. Now, if you think about it, there's, 6-7 million people, a billion people in the world today.
Yeah.
That's a 10-digit figure. So what one achieves is an impossibility, or the fact that every one of us could be, and probably are, in some way or another,
related.
The way branches move out, descended from just about anybody in the first century.
Yeah.
So the question I normally get asked is, in terms of now or recent history, what's so important about this bloodline? Are there descendants around today? Well, yes, of course there are. Millions, probably. But what I tried to do was, wherever I could find the firstborn, I tried to follow the firstborn, and I had to do it with family registers and that sort of thing, and they very rarely got involved with females, so they always were interested in the male, the senior son of the line.
Really?
Because he was probably the prince of something or the king of something or whatever. So it wasn't too difficult to sort of follow the senior son of the senior son, you know, that sort of thing. And it moved into to many of the noble families of Europe and many reigning houses. So it was kind of intriguing. But in terms of importance, you can imagine that as every single generation passes, it dilutes. And so today there's no importance to it at all. I mean, you know, we've all got a bit of it in us somewhere, and we've all got a bit of anybody else in the first century somewhere in us, and it makes little difference. And the conclusion I came to anyway, even following the bloodline, was that where there were those that were recorded in detail in history, be they kings or whatever they were, there were the good ones and the bad ones, just like anything else. You know, there were the honest ones and the crooked ones, just like any other family line. So in terms of importance, you know, everybody that came from the line certainly wasn't a Jesus character, you know, and certainly couldn't have been. That would never happen in any family. So my interest in it, and in fact my readership's main interest, is not based on that, and it's not based on today. It's really just based on a retelling of an aspect of history that not much has been taught about, if anything.
Yes.
And so it's a historical interest, really, and you know, that's the way that I approached it, without really a need or a desire to prove anything at all. You know, it didn't
right.
to me. You know, it didn't affect my life. Whether there was a family line that one could trace or, in any way, and knowing about it today is certainly not going to pay anybody's mortgage or make their life better. You know, it's historical interest.
Have you noticed that there is? I mean, are there? Do you know if there are any royal houses around? Well, the world, I guess we can say at this point, that are actually interested in this story? I mean, have you worked for any of them to, like, follow the lineage of them and see if there are actually more related or not to this, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, there are loads of royal houses around now that were dispossessed or, you know, moved into exile or whatever throughout history. I mean, there aren't that many reigning European houses now. There's a handful, but not many of them. But in terms of the general picture that I got, I was kind of surprised once I decided to look at particular family lines. It was a surprise to me to discover that when I started to question some of these noble families about it, let's say that, you know, the House of de Rohan in France, or, you know, the sort of houses that were very, very prominent until comparatively recent times. French Revolution, this sort of era, and around there, kind of took it on board as a matter of course and said, well, yes, of course, we know that. You know, it wasn't a surprise to them.
Mm-hmm.
They were surprised by the fact that anybody would be interested. by the fact that they were descended from this line.
Okay.
And it was one of the ways that I found it not difficult to get hold of family archives and to sort of check through some of the descents to see, you know, where these houses came from. And, I mean, in the end, I didn't know where to go with it because there were so many families that claimed descent or whom I found a descent in. I didn't know which family to follow finally, and I thought, well, actually, since I'm a British author with a book coming out of Britain, I suppose I really ought to follow the British line, you know, the line that was the last traceable reigning house in Britain.
Right.
And that turned out to be the Royal House of Stuart. And you know, they reigned in Scotland from 1371. They reigned in England also from 1603, and they finally moved out of office in 1688, and that was the end of it. But they actually, of all families, interestingly, you know, the longest reigning ever of all European royal houses.
Mm-hmm.
So that was again a surprise to me. It's not something that we're taught at school, but we had a reigning house here, which you know was the longest reigning. That was quite something. One gets fooled with a lot of countries, with the Louis in France and that sort of thing, because you think that's a long reigning house, and it isn't. I mean, it's a bit like the Pharaohs and whatever. They just kept taking these same names, but they weren't the same families, and they weren't necessarily descended. May have been for a few generations, but not long. But the Royal House of Stuart was interesting, and so that kind of was where my book finished. And I thought, well, I'll just trace the family line down to today and see who's around, you know, today as head of that house. And I did that trace, and that was where the book finished.
Now, do you want
to... I really was from the first century right down to date.
Yes, okay, I got you. And of course, do you want to talk a little bit about Prince Michael of Albany? I don't know the full title of him, but there is a continuation then of the Royal House of Stuart, in your opinion, right?
Oh yeah, I mean, well, not in my opinion, but in terms of you know, family archive and national archives in France and Belgium and whatever.
Right.
I mean, all of these royal houses. I mean, the House of Bourbon and you know, it doesn't really matter where you go. There weren't many royal houses in Europe that finished because the family line deceased with no heir. They were deposed, or the church got in the way, they were exiled, or whatever happened. Well, that still left somebody, and the lines continued. And very many of these families, I mean, even the House of Napoleon still exists, you know, it's still there.
Mm.
And the descendants are still there. And remarkably, what I discovered was, it was surprising, because behind the scenes, a lot of these families were really doing quite a lot of work, as if they were still reigning princes.
Really?
They were, you know, acting as constitutional advisors, all sorts of things behind the scenes. And so, you know, in terms of Prince Michael, who's the current head of the House of Stuart and has been since 1958, and he was very young in 1958, and he was hardly born, but the fact was, you know, he was a minority head and became active by the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact was that I had him as the last descendant I could discover in my research, about in my collection here, about 5 years before I ever really heard about him or met him.
Mm.
And I was simply here one day at home listening to an interview program on the radio. It's one of these things that we have every week. It's called Midweek, and they have sort of four interesting guests that come from, you know, different areas of life, and a woman who sort of interviews them all, and they all have a chat. And lo and behold, on this BBC program was Prince Michael of Albany.
Hmm.
And I thought, wow, this is the guy that I sort of traced, but I never knew where he was or how to get hold of him. And So we rang up the BBC, and they very kindly gave us a phone number.
It was, there you go.
They wouldn't do it today, but they did then. And so within a few days, I was up in Scotland and met with Michael, and that was in 1991. And of course, from meeting him, I got led to meet other members of his family, his mother, his father, his grandmother, and various things, and I was granted access to the immense Stuart family archive. And so I was able to complete my picture and able to finish the book with it. So, I mean, he again, you know, as the head of a royal house, was in Scotland then. He had come over from Belgium in 1976. And what I discovered was exactly the same as I did with so many others. I mean, he was involved in so much work, mainly charitable, but, I mean, this guy was involved in what might, one might call sort of the fringe of diplomatic work, certainly as a constitutional advisor on the one hand, and at the other end of it, he'd opened up a soup kitchen for the homeless in Edinburgh, and he was driving old people around in coaches and giving them trips to the seaside. So, I mean, at every level of sort of social help, from the very top to the very bottom, I invented a word, and I said, this must be princing. Hmm. You know, I just felt that this was proper princing. This was like a service, you know, to the nation. And, you know, I probably found the busiest, most underpaid person I'd ever met in my life.
So, I mean, if we backtrack a little bit and try to get some perspective on that, because today we can kind of look at the royals or any royal basically, they're on either on a throne or what have you, and kind of, okay, they're up there, they have a certain amount of power, wealth obviously, and things like this, the status of course, the titles and what have you. But I mean, if we go further back into history, and I've kind of always wondered how a royal house kind of even get started. I mean, and I'd like to ask you what your take on that is, and even if you've been able to find something. This idea of either if we call it divine right to rule or whatever it is, it's something that separates them from the rest of us, if you will.
Yeah, well, it changed dramatically in the year 751. So remember that date. It's very important because the whole nature of monarchy throughout Europe changed from that date. If one goes back to the earliest of times and kingship, really, in terms of record, kingship seems to have begun in about 3,800, 4,000 BC in Mesopotamia. The first kings on record were from that era. Mm-hmm. And one moves from there into the earliest, the first dynasty of Egypt and kings before even the first dynasty. So one is in that sort of fertile crescent area of the world where kings evolved. And at that time, all records seem to be of the opinion that not only were these kings sort of treated like gods, but they were sort of god kings. And there was something special or seemingly semi-divine about them or whatever.
How?
That's kind of where it started, and I'm not even sure what that was based on, but mm-hmm. they seem to do a pretty good job. If one moves forward in time from there, you get to the point where what's happening is that these kings are becoming territorial invaders. For one reason or other, they're expanding their empires and they're moving into other people's lands, so you've now got kingship by takeover.
Yes.
And that seems to have settled really quite nicely by about the 300s, that sort of period, 300s, 400s, certainly by the 500s, where kingship became an institution that, certainly within the Celtic realms of Europe, which was much more based on sort of educational pursuits, agriculture, trade, international trade, this sort of thing, rather than being military, as it became again later on. And there was a sort of a culture at that time where the kings of lands, again, the Celtic realms within the Scythian realms and this sort of thing, were not owners of anything. That what happened was that the king didn't even own his own life, knife and fork. He certainly didn't own any territory. And the king would be looked after and provided with castles and just about everything else that was wanted by the people as long as he did a good job.
Right.
So he ended up being effectively and seemingly the most wealthy person in the land because he had the finest of everything. But it was only there as long as he did a good job. And it seems that from about 300, 400 through to about 700, when lot of problem for the church, and it caused an immense problem for the church, because the church was trying to, from the 4th century, was trying to control the Western world by way of what it called apostolic descent.
Mm-hmm.
So the popes were seemingly, and in a pseudo-fashion, determined as being descended from St. Peter, not from Jesus, because that line was already there reigning as kings. So they were descended from St. Peter, but they weren't actually. It was just a sort of laying on hands procedure, which still exists today. You know?
Right,
so whenever the next pope arrives, the previous pope lays on hands and immediately makes him a son or a descendant. which is kind of weird, but it caused a lot of problem, and the church was becoming very, very powerful. And what happened was that probably the most important document that's ever existed or been written in terms of governmental and control within Europe was produced in the year 751. And Pope Zachary at the time produced this document, and he said, "Look here, fellows, look what I found here. This is a document written by Emperor Constantine back in the 4th century." But it wasn't. It was an absolute forgery, but they didn't discover that for another 600 years.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's reckoned to be the most important and famous forgery in history, but it was called the Donation of Constantine.
Okay, right.
And what it stated within many, many pages of writing about monarchical and church procedure and government was that Jesus had told Emperor Constantine, this is in the 4th century, that all kings of all kingdoms must be chosen, elected, and crowned by the Pope.
There you go.
So it was a brilliant strategy, and it worked. And it's the reason why even today, you know, the Pope or the head of the Church of England here in Britain, the Archbishop of Canterbury, crowned the monarch.
There you go, yeah.
And that's happened since the year 751. And it's still, if one looks up the Donation of Constantine in an encyclopedia, it will say this is the most famous forgery in all history.
And yet
everybody knows that.
And yet it continues.
Well, it's a tradition now, and nobody changes it. I mean, it's kind of weird, isn't it?
Yeah, very weird.
But what happened was that it's become dynastic again, or in fact, you know, for quite a lot of years now, it's become dynastic again. But the culture and the tradition is still there, that the head of the church has to crown the next in line. But from 751, what actually happened was that they used it as a means and a method of getting rid of all the kingly lines they didn't like.
So
various, you know, kingly lines that had been dynastic for a few hundred years in Europe were just wiped out in 751 and replaced by pawns, really. I mean, manipulative pawns of the church. And one from that period, apart from King Alfred in Britain and one or two other exceptions, Charlemagne, for example, he was another exception,
mm-hmm.
who hated the church, even though he was head of the Holy Roman Empire. There were exceptions, but generally it was a very bad period of monarchy for some long time after that, until it found its feet again. And by the time it had found its feet again, people started to want to become republican, and you've got the various revolutions, and you're into the French Revolution and everything else.
Mm.
And so monarchies got deposed again at that stage. And now we're left with very few, and those that are there, Britain's a little bit different, actually. I mean, the monarchies of Europe that exist now exist by way of empowerment by the constitutions of the countries that they're monarchs of, and so the written constitution of let's say, you know, Belgium or Spain empowers the monarch to be there to act on behalf of the people.
Mm.
And Britain is a little bit different because we don't have a written constitution in Britain. What we have is a series of traditions that we call a constitution, but the monarch is only empowered in Britain by the government.
Right.
And that's an intriguing set of circumstances. It happened in 1691, where William of Orange had invaded Britain and sort of grabbed the monarchy. And the government decided at that particular time that, you know, since he'd sort of done this thing, that they were going to restrict his powers. And the document was issued at that time, a bill of rights, really, and it stated that henceforth the monarch of Britain shall only reign by consent of Parliament, and that still exists today. So,
do you think that that's only on the surface, though? Is that what, or is do you think no, that
it's very much a real thing? You know, that our Queen in Britain, apart from the fact that, you know, traditionally she's well loved, and it's probably one of the best known people worldwide, has much more limited powers than other monarchs in Europe, much more limited powers.
So even though she says, you know, she talks about it as my government, that's yes, only...
In effect, she has to empower the government, but she only exists by virtue of governmental consent. So whereas one could say that the European monarchies in general are constitutional monarchies, mm-hmm. ours is designated as a parliamentary monarchy, which is a different thing. And she has no power to change laws. She has no power to enact acts of parliament, whereas other monarchs do. So it's one of the reasons actually why it makes it quite easy to criticise. Is probably the wrong word, but quite often our royal family is either criticised for talking about something that it shouldn't talk about because it's none of their business, or it's criticised for not making a stand about something in particular, which sure. actually it's not empowered to do.
Sure.
So they're really on a bit of a losing wicket a lot of the time. It just so happens that they survive very well because they're very popular, and the institution itself is, you know, is a global tradition now, and it's maintained. But quite frankly, I personally kind of wish that there was a parallel. You know, that there are a lot of things that the government in Britain can do without anybody to challenge them, and that doesn't happen in other countries in Europe. You know, that there is an equal right of challenge, and monarchs can in fact get acts of parliament overturned if the people are supporting them.
Mm.
The people support them through the press and the media, and governments have climbed down many times.
Right. So you wouldn't say at this point that there is a relationship between the two where the Royal House of England do has influence over what goes on in politics and finance and so forth within the country?
I think they have influence.
Yeah.
But what they don't have is power. And you know, there is a difference. In as much as that their wishes are not necessarily respected, but their opinions are respected. And if they do make remarks about something where they don't feel it's right or whatever, the governmental ministers do go back to the drawing board. Now, sometimes they'll just really, you know, come up again with what they wanted to do in the first place. Other times you'll see that things have changed. In fact, Prince Charles is quite good at that. He's criticised because he talks a lot, and sometimes you think, oh, why the heck is he talking about that? You know, it doesn't really seem that relevant. But
right.
But it does feed through the media, and you know, there are we have, like most countries, newspapers that lean one way or another, to the left or to the right, and in politics, and they also lean to be pro or anti monarchy on the other.
Mm.
There are many in the country that would like Britain to be thoroughly republican and to lose the monarchy, and then there are the others that stand up and will fight battles to save it all. You know?
Right. Well, I mean, there are people who claim that there is incredible wealth, if we talk about the Windsors, for instance, behind them, and that they do have access to a lot of money and so forth. And so one question that kind of automatically pops up, because I know the conversation has been on the front lines of the newspapers here in Sweden as well about the monarchy here, is that, you like, do we really need them? They don't have the, on the surface then at least, the influence or power, as you say, but yet again, they are there for, what do you think, only for the sake of tradition? It ends up causing a lot of money for people and tax money and so forth. Do you think it's tradition, and it's is it enough, so to speak, to just have them in there for the sake of tradition? What do you think, Lawrence?
Well, I mean, in terms of wealth, yes, they have a lot of wealth, but basically it's public money. You know, I mean, they have the great art collection here, the Windsors, but it's a publicly owned art collection, really. You know, it's interesting to look at the figures as a whole, because generally, when one hears how much they might cost in terms of money from taxes to be there running these lovely houses and doing the things that they do, that normally comes from a criticism of some sort or a right of challenge. But what doesn't get reflected in those sort of discussions, and it'll be the same for you and everywhere else, is that it doesn't actually explain in those articles how much money they bring in.
Mm.
And in Britain, it is perfectly clear that in terms of global tourism, they are the House of Windsor and its palaces and its art collections and all that stuff, they are the biggest tourist attraction in this country. And in terms of what they bring in financially, it exceeds what they receive financially to run that business on.
Mm-hmm.
It very much is a business, of course.
Sure.
And so, you know, I'm not a supporter or a believer of this nonsense that they cost a lot of money. Actually, the balance sheet, when it's drawn up, shows that they provide profit.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And profit of quite some considerable value. They also, because of the fact that they are designated, various members of the family are designated dukes of this or duchesses of that, and basically control counties within the country and whatever, put a lot of time and effort and money back into those areas that they are the nobility of. And all sorts of things happen where money doesn't seemingly have to come from the government or from taxes directly. You know, it comes from, you know, let's say the Duke of Cornwall estate or something like that.
Mm.
And so there's a lot that happens within society and sort of on the ground, so to speak, where money comes back onto the ground, you know, building houses, all this sort of thing. So it's a bit of a circle. You know, the money goes out one way and comes back another way. It goes out as money and comes back as services. And farming, agriculture, there's a lot of support. There are so many charities that they front, you know, and enormous amounts of money go into those. So my personal feeling is that I love the idea of monarchies because I like the idea of there being a challenge or somebody to act on behalf of people when governments don't. And governments seem to not work on behalf of people most of the time. It's one of the points that I've made in a lot of my books. If one reads any description in any dictionary of the word democracy, and it will tell us every single time that democracy means government by the people, for the people. And I don't know when I've ever really seen government by the people, for the people. What one generally and seemingly always sees is government of the people. You know, we seem to get laws made around us whether we like it or not.
Do you think
idea of monarchy, certainly in a constitutional situation, is that it gives the people a champion, a figurehead,
mm-hmm.
that has the right to challenge on those occasions, which unfortunately our monarchy doesn't. But I'd love the idea of monarchy to go back pre-751 and for it to have the rights and privileges that it did there to literally champion people and not to be personally wealthy, but to gain their establishments by virtue of the fact that they don't get moved out of office because people think they're doing a good job.
What in a way you're kind of talking about there is you're talking about the real king, in a way, the one who stands with their people and not behind them,
yeah.
when they go into battle, right? The one
yeah.
who actually spearheads the the leadership, if you will.
That's
Do you think that the monarchy, you know, if, let's say that they were come in a position of power today then or in some other way, do you think that they would do a better job then than most governments do?
I don't know that it's a question of doing a better job, because I mean the idea of governmental structure has been around for a heck of a long time. I mean, you know, Parliament was set up in Britain in the 1100s and I mean the concept is I have no problem with the concept of governments, and I believe that nobody would dispute the fact that an elected body should be better than a dynastic body that just gets, you know, a heritable right to a position.
Right,
but
because
the problem is that there is we have good governments and we have bad governments all the time, and it seems that whenever bad things are happening, I mean, it's a bit like now, you know, with governments leaping in to put billions of pounds and dollars of public money into supporting the banks who have fallen apart because, you know, they've done all the wrong things. And, that's okay, I suppose, but how is it that we end up paying all the time?
Yeah, exactly.
It goes wrong.
Yeah.
Now, what I feel is that if there were an empowered monarch to challenge that sort of situation on behalf of the people, it wouldn't necessarily stop it happening, but it would certainly ensure that the support came about in a different way that was fair, more fair.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that I want to see. There's nothing on the other side of the scales. You know, the government will always win. It will always make laws whether we want them or not. You never, or very rarely, have referenda for anything that is contentious or in dispute. And now it's kind of got worse because with the European Union, I mean, we now discover that most of our lives are not even run by our own governments.
That's
true.
They're
run by a European Commission made up of people that none of us elected.
Yeah.
And probably don't even know who they are for the most part.
Sure.
And yet they are making all these rules and running everything. So, again, I see the need for something to be there as an institution to weigh the other side of the scales and to bring things into a better balance so that we're not dictated to all the time and have to suffer every time when they decide what moves they're going to make.
All right. Yeah. Really interesting hearing from your perspective here, Lawrence. And we're kind of approaching the end of our time together here in the first segment. And do you feel up for continuing a conversation with us?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it.
Very good. And I want to leave the last few minutes to you, though, so you can mention a few of your titles and your website. And I guess the best way to go to get copies of some of your books, is that to your website?
Oh, yes, certainly. The website's a very fast and easy way to go to get copies of the book. You know, it just links through to Amazon and click away and you have a copy of the book on your doorstep within a couple of days. But, I mean, all of my books are available in good bookshops, good bookstores. They're all in a variety of languages. I think overall, if one counts the languages that they're in, they're not all in the same languages, but they're into about 24 languages in all, each one. So, I mean, and there are seven books, so, you know, seven books of an average of 20 languages a book. That's a lot of books.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's not difficult to get them at all. And
in terms
of the titles, you mentioned those. In fact, I really ought to alter my website because a couple of the things that I've still got on there, I've kind of retired from now.
Okay, right.
I had a couple of years ago some nasty surgery that ended up sort of knocking me out of the public limelight for a while. I wasn't able to give lectures or to do television and things. And at the same time, I pulled away from the active roles in some of the orders that I was involved with. But
okay. Mm-hmm.
Just as an example, you mentioned that it says on there I was attaché to the European Council of Princes.
Yeah.
I'm not actually now, but I mean, I'm still involved, but I don't do that now because I had to give it up. But essentially, going back to what we were speaking to, I mentioned all of these noble and royal houses that were exiled and deposed and aren't reigning now. They still exist and they band together within this thing called the European Council of Princes. So they've actually got like their own club. Where they meet and debate various things and various of them are advisors to the European Union.
But that's interesting though, because then we kind of end up back in the situation where we talked about how the European Union is taking over, but...
That's right, but I'm not saying they're advisors. What I'm not saying is that they're taken any notice of a lot of the time. I mean,
right, okay.
but the fact is that... So I became involved with them really because of the fact that I was a constitutional historian and my learning process for a very long time has been about keeping up with national constitutions and the changes within them and so I began to be sort of used by the council and eventually became a part of it, you know, as a non-prince, but I became a sort of advisor to the advisors.
Right.
And it was very interesting. I did that for about 10 years.
There's a lot of bureaucracy in there, or can you actually get things done? How does it work?
There's no bureaucracy at all. It's a very pleasant environment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like they all meet every month or anything like that. That doesn't happen. I mean, it's mainly just a sort of connection through telephone calls and emails and things, and perhaps once every couple of years there might be a get-together, that sort of thing, in Strasbourg or somewhere like Frankfurt, maybe somewhere like that, and that's kind of fun. It's usually a little bit ceremonial and quite nice.
Right.
But again, you know, it has a ring to it, the European Council of Princes. I mean, it sounds, you know, I was going to say it sounds exciting. It is exciting, but actually it's just a bunch of men and women doing a lot of good work charitably and whatever else. kind of retaining and maintaining the links with each other that were there in reality as their families' reigning situations a couple of hundred years ago, maybe. And so it's very easy historically to forget them and to forget these families, but it doesn't mean they don't exist just because they're not reigning anymore.
Right. Yeah, that's true. So in regards to like the conversation we had today, is there any specific book you'd like to recommend in regards to some of the history here that we've been talking about today?
Golly, well, I think we've been in and out of a number of books, really. I mean, I suppose the book I always like to recommend is the current one.
Yes.
It's always the latest book that is the easiest to get.
Mention that for us, then.
And that's called The Grail Enigma. It's a good book to get because when I said before, the publishers don't actually like rewrites and updates of books. It did, in my mind, become very necessary to write what I would consider a second edition and an update on Bloodline of the Holy Grail, which was my first book, which was 12 years ago. And essentially what I did was that instead of producing it as an update or a second edition of that book, I wrote it as an entirely new book with a different title. And within it is all the stuff I would have loved to have put into Bloodline of the Holy Grail, but didn't, or I've learned since it was published, and it's now, you know, there to write about. And the nice thing about The Grail Enigma is that one doesn't have to have read Bloodline of the Holy Grail to read it, because anything that one needs to know necessarily from the first book, I've put in there again anyway. So it's good advice to say that to recommend any of my books, if one is particularly interested, it's best to start with the first one and run through the series from there.
Yes.
But actually, one could buy the last one and still feel that one was back at the beginning.
Sounds good.
So, there's my answer, really.
Yeah, good way to tie it together there. Yeah, exactly. So do head on over to Lauren's website, graal.co.uk. That's graal.co.uk, and click on a new book from the front page, and you also can read a little bit more about the Grail Enigma right there. So thank you very much for this first segment, Lawrence. Stay with us then, and we'll continue talking in a little while in our member section.
Okay, we'll do that. Thank you.
Before we end our first part and continue with Lawrence, I want to mention the Stars and Stones Forum this coming Saturday and Sunday, the 15th and 16th of November. This is with Dan Winter, Edmund Marriage, Daniel Tatman, Samir Osmanagic, and others. I have a link on the front page where you can get all the information. We also have some other upcoming events in November listed on our front page, and we'll mention a few more of those as we get closer, but take a look there for more information and all the links. Thank you for listening to our first part with Lawrence Gardner. We'll continue our conversation now for Red Eyes members. We're going to get into the area of the Grail and tie it together with the royal bloodlines. We're also going to talk about the roots of these bloodlines and again tie it back to Sumeria and talk about the Anunnaki or even Anunnagi and their connection and what separates, if anything, these guys from the rest of the population. We'll also talk more about monoatomic gold or Mufkut and the importance of gold in some new discoveries in regards to scientific and technological improvements that has to do with gold. If you're not a member, don't miss this continuation of our program with Lawrence Gardner or all the other material that we have up there for you. Live webcasts, video interviews, extended interviews, and our entire radio archive. Head on over to redeyescreations.com, click on subscribe, sign up, and you'll get instant access. Again, live show on Saturday with Jake Kotze. Check it out and tell your friends. More with Lawrence Gardner after this.